cavernous deeps.
Yuck. That's a trailer from Cataclysm, a video game from the famous World of Warcraft series. Sounds more like a horror film, doesn't it? But the bloodier the better, it seems, for gamers whose thirst for violence seems unquenchable at times. But studies have linked, well, and we've all read about them, the studies that have linked exposure to such violence with aggressive behavior. Joining us now is OSU communication professor Dave Ewaldson, whose recently published study found that these violent video games aren't as harmful, at least when players are able to cooperate with each other. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me here.
Question for our listeners. Don't wait. Give us a call right now. Have you played any video games that have been labeled violent? And if so, what effect have they had on your behavior, do you think? Or do you get what we're talking about when we talk about the cooperative games? Dave, you found that the social aspect of today's games, because they can be cooperative,
right,
is different than maybe even 10 years ago.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The nature of the games has changed quite a bit. And our stereotype was always of the lone gamer playing for hours a violent game. And that is no longer the case. Surveys suggest that people like to play games in groups, and they like to play what we call cooperative competition. So they're playing in a group against another group or against a computer.
And so when you talk about in a group, when I think of it in our household, somebody's sometimes playing online. When you studied it, it wasn't online play, but it was simulated in a way?
Well, what we did in one of the studies, it was Halo, which is a very popular franchise. And with Halo, you can actually play 16 people, at least in the like Halo 2, could play simultaneously, but it would be four groups of four. And so what we were looking at in these studies was actually just two people playing, and they either played together against the game to see how far they could get through it, or they played head-to-head against each other, so they were killing each other, or they were told, see how far you can get through the game, who gets the furthest wins. It was more like the Xbox games and the PlayStation and things like that we were looking at.
And did you watch them as they were playing the game and look at how differently they played the game?
In the first study, we didn't videotape them. In the second study, we videotaped them and we recorded everything they said. And in the second study, we actually had a Confederate who, and what was fun is the Confederate either played in an OSU sweatshirt or in a Michigan sweatshirt, because we were also interested in, does a rivalry get rid of any cooperative effects, or what's the effect of that?
Or does cooperation
overcome
change the rivalry?
And which is what we found,
uh-huh,
is that when you played with a Michigan player afterwards, you were very cooperative. And if anything, playing with a Michigan player decreased your propensity to be aggressive. And you cooperated just the same with them as you did as an OSU student. And before they played, they made some pretty snarky comments to the person in the Michigan t-shirt.
Oh, that couldn't be.
Oh, I know. Here at OSU, that would never happen. And in that one, we taped them, and also the Confederate twice asked for help, and you saw very different reactions to the request for help when they were playing competitive versus cooperatively. So when they were playing competitively, the other person would always respond, but it would be like, oh, you need some health potions? Well, they're on the floor. Go look for them. Whereas we had people actually would go back and find them in the game and take them and say, here's a health thing right here for you, or here's a weapon that you need that will help you do better. So the helping behavior within the game was very different when they were playing cooperative versus competitive, which isn't really that surprising. But it was interesting work to do.
Talking with David Ewaldson, he's a professor of communication at The Ohio State University. We're talking about a study they did on video games and their impact, violent video games, I guess, and the impact on people's behavior, who play them. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org if you have a question or comment for Dave. What inspired you to do this study in the first place and in this way?
Well, one of the things, part of it was watching my own sons play video games and seeing the difference in their behavior both while they were playing and afterwards when they played cooperatively versus competitively. And when they played cooperatively, we never had any problems. They'd never get upset with each other. I shouldn't say never, but rarely. They were brothers. but when they play competitively, almost always I would have to make them shut off the video game because it would turn into a fight. And not anything nasty, but also, it was just that the popularity of violent video games was growing rapidly. And we weren't seeing the corresponding increases in violent crimes that you would suspect.
That had been predicted?
Right, right, mm-hmm. exactly. Now, I'm not saying that the research linking violent video games to aggression is wrong. I'd never want to say that. But what we were trying to demonstrate is it's more complex than that. And what really struck me is as I watched my sons play these games, how much they would help each other during the games when they were playing cooperatively. And that just struck me as very contrary to this notion that playing a violent game is going to make you all aroused and think all these horrible things and then act aggressively. Well, helping somebody seems very at odds with those predictions.
It seems like the sort of thing they're trying to teach them when you join the military or something.
Exactly. And actually, one of the early people that was very interested in this was somebody in the military. They wanted to talk with us about doing some research. That was back, I was down at the University of Alabama when we started this work, and that was down there. And then I moved to OSU, and we stopped that conversation. But they were wanting to talk with us about some of the military simulations they do. And also, I kept going back, you know, which has a stronger effect on a person's behavior, killing a virtual creature or working together with another human?
With a real person.
Yeah, with a real person. And it struck me that the behavior with the real person should have the stronger effects. And that's what we found now across 4 or 5 studies now, is we consistently find whether we're measuring later cooperative behavior, whether we're measuring later aggressive behavior. I mean, what we find is when with aggressive behavior, if you play it competitively, you're aggressive later on. If you play cooperatively, it's just like you didn't play the game in terms of later aggression.
Rich in Dublin, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Rich.
Well, thank you. My question for the professor is, has he done any research into guilds online, people who play together regularly, like a MMO to achieve a specific goal? They have regular teams and they work together. And as a former player, I found that I've made friendships that last beyond the game with people who I don't know and who live somewhere else and I've never actually met.
Yeah, we haven't done research with MMOs yet. We would like to do that.
What's
quickly.
An MMO? Can you explain what?
Well, that's like World of Warcraft, the games where you're online and you could be playing with people anywhere in the world. I mean, technically with Xbox Live, you can do that as well. But with Xbox Live, you're limited to a couple of other players. With an MMO, well, maybe the caller could explain it better than I can, but you could be playing with millions of people simultaneously.
How does that work, Rich?
Well, you start by just running together and doing content with people that you don't know. And if you have a good time, then you might chat with them a little bit. And then eventually they form into a guild, which is a offline group. They may have a forum offline or some other way of contacting one another offline to arrange, okay, it's Wednesday, it's 8:00. I'm going to be on and do this. And these people who I've done content with before are going to join me and we're all going to do it together. If you do it regularly enough, then you have a team, and they will bring their friends in, and so it becomes a real social group
yeah.
and a real social outlet, despite the fact that these people may not have met in real life.
I mean, the first longitudinal study on violent video games was with an MMO, and it was a Dungeons & Dragons spinoff. I don't remember the exact name of the game. And there are methodological problems with the study, but the thing that struck me is they had people play for a month, and the average person played over 50 hours. And given what we know from the literature on violent video games, that should have been more than enough to increase their aggressive behavior. And they were looking at interpersonal aggression. So how aggressive are you with your friends, with your partner, stuff like that.
After you're done playing?
Right, exactly. Okay. And they found nothing. Now, their explanation was that these were fantasy creatures that were being attacked. Our explanation was the only way you can succeed in most MMOs is by cooperating. And again, that cooperating with real people was a much more powerful effect on people's behavior. I can't say much more powerfully, but it had a stronger effect on people's behavior than killing fantasy creatures. And that's just always one of the things that struck me about the research is that it's not that the research is wrong, but that it's simplistic. That and again, for what it studies, the research conclusions are pretty strong, but most people don't play that way. So let's look at the social factors and how that influences it.
Rich, thanks for your call.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Your study focused on pretty much one demographic,
right.
College students. Did they tend to be more male than female, or did you do
In the first study we did with Halo, it was more women than men, actually.
Okay.
In the second study, I think it was a fairly even balance, and I'm not sure. It might have been more males than females. But that, again, is another one of those things where we tend to think about boys playing games more than girls do. But that actually, the statistics are, we find that, the gender differences in video game play are diminishing. Now, women tend to play different types of games than men. We find some evidence of that, but again, it's not an overwhelming difference.
And did you see any distinction between the genders in your studies?
No. No, we found no effect in terms of, for example, with the first play with Halo, we found no differences, or again, a minor differences that women tended to cooperate more, if I remember right. But still, the general effect that playing cooperatively increased cooperative play held across genders.
An email from Charles in Whitehall. He says, I'm a gamer from the 80s. I've played the realm of violent games from Mortal Kombat to Killer Instinct to Call of Duty, etc. I played along with my friends, and none of us have police records or have ever been prone to violence.
Exactly. That's our point.
I mean, the place we'd be run amok with violence by now, given how many people play.
Exactly. I mean, one of the things I always tell my students is you can have Gandhi play Grand Theft Auto for 6 weeks, and he's not going to become, he wouldn't have become a violent person. I mean, there are a lot of factors that are going to influence it. And again, we think one of the important things is cooperative play, that social context of play. Like the first caller said, I mean, a lot of friendships develop out of this. And there's research, a lot of research showing that video games have become an important part of adolescents' lives. And again, it's for the social component of it. You play with your friends. That's how you create and maintain a lot of friendships. Not all friendships, obviously, but it plays an important role in that.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us to talk about it. I look forward to what's coming up next with your work.
Thanks very much. I enjoyed the time on the show today. Thank you.
David Ebeltson, he's professor of communication at Ohio State University. Coming up, we're going to talk about iTunes U Boot Camp, going to school on iTunes. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Barack Obama and Mitt Romney have crafted their campaign narratives, telling you who they are, what they've done, and how they would lead America. But there's more to their stories. Tonight on WOSU-TV, Frontline presents The Choice 2012, journey into the people, places, and distinctive moments that made the men who they are. Hundreds of hours of research reveal new details and fresh insights about the two candidates. Watch Frontline The Choice. It's tonight at 9 on WOSU-TV. 44 degrees. We'll see sunshine today, warming up to 62. Clouds for tonight, a low of 45 degrees. Support for 89.7 comes from United Healthcare, helping companies realize the rewards of better health in the workplace. On the web at uhctoday.com/rewards. And All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
iTunes has quickly grown from music and movies to a bank of media and information all at your fingertips. iTunes U is what Apple calls the world's largest online catalog of free education content, and Ohio State is among many universities incorporating it into its curriculum. Here to talk about how they're doing that is Liev Yestvang and Michael Hoffer. He is from OSU's Digital First Initiative. Welcome, Liev and Michael.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
It's free and anyone can watch. Then this isn't necessarily about helping people get their degrees. I wanted to talk about that right off the bat when we talk about iTunes U. Liev, what is the content intended for?
So there are two different ways that iTunes U can be used. A course can be created that can be kept closed just for students in a particular course. So faculty could design an online course that's actually set up to enhance a course that they teach at Ohio State for their students. So they may have video clips of lectures. They can link to apps or to outside sites that may have additional information that would kind of enhance the student experience for their course. And then these courses can be made open to the public. And that's part of what we're seeing at Ohio State. We've had several faculty members who have published courses for the world. And we've seen a massive amount of interest from really across the globe, people who are interested in learning about the kinds of things that we teach at Ohio State.
How do we know about the numbers, about how many people are actually using it?
So we track these numbers. We know actually to the person who is watching this information and where they're coming from. So we've seen, if we look at our data from March, from just over 6 months ago, we had about 3,000 downloads in the month of March of content on iTunes U. And cumulatively since then, we've had 500,000 downloads. So we've actually had several courses at OSU promoted on the national iTunes U site. They're featured among courses from Stanford and MIT and Harvard. And that amount of focus, you know, being sort of up in the lights on the iTunes U site has drawn a lot of attention to what we're doing.
So how do you know, Michael, what works on an iTunes U download? I mean, what works once somebody downloads it? How does it work?
Yeah, so there's a lot of ways that we see it works. The courses themselves we run through, and what we were focused on was the boot camp and the experience that we run with the faculty member to help develop those courses. So whether that's a flipped classroom where the lecture is online, or it's something like we're doing in astronomy where we get live feeds from the Mars rover, and those feeds are put into a molecular app, so students actually could see the three-dimensional structure of those molecules live from Mars in real time. So it's those things that drive general interest, but providing this, you know, platform for all of us to use from a course to the broader open sense.
If Digital First is offering its second iTunes U faculty boot camp in December to help faculty learn to incorporate the digital media into their courses, does the faculty at all resent this? Like, it's just one more layer of stuff they have to do now, another platform that they have to prepare. Have you had any pushback on that score, Michael?
I think there's always a little pushback whenever you're doing something different and something new. But we also have a lot of faculty that are really excited about this. And it's our job, you know, and I look at our job and the role we play in the university to promote that change and look at where student expectations are and where the industry is going and help faculty understand the benefits of doing this, of getting their material out to the public. So while there's some that say, what do we do with this? It's a scary time in higher education with things like MOOCs and open educational resources. There's a lot of people that are embracing it as well.
And leave the students?
The students are really excited about it. So I think for them to be able to access course material outside of class, it's that students are connected all of the time anyway. So they're accessing information and material. And for them to be able to learn how to access information that's good information and to think about kind of developing the skills to be critical thinkers about the information that is out there is something that's really important for them. And so students, what we're seeing, Michael mentioned the flipped classroom model, which is a model that takes some of the lecture material that students would have sat in a lecture room and listened to and then gone away and worked on problems. There's some switch in that now so that students are watching some of the lecture material outside of class and then coming to class and working with each other and with the faculty member to solve problems and to have discussions and to really engage around the content. And I think that it's an exciting way for students to connect with each other and to connect with their instructors and with the material that they're learning in their courses when it's in a way that's collaborative and that's interactive in the classroom.
Talking with iTunes U Bootcamp, I guess, developers, Lieve Gestvan and Michael Hoffner, It's Hoffer. Okay, OSU Digital First Program. If you have a question or comment for them, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. I'd love to hear from somebody who's used iTunes U, maybe the one from some of the courses from OSU or elsewhere, and can give us a call and tell us, you know, whether it helped you or not. Maybe your demographic will be telling as well. The students, most of the students at Ohio State have grown up with the internet now. It's completely different.
Yeah, and I think when we look at that, right, we look back, I always tell people, close your eyes and look back 5 years ago. There was no iPads. There was no iPhones. iTunes U was in its infancy. And, you know, trying to move us forward in that arena is the challenge right now and how we meet those student expectations.
Can anybody download it? You don't have to be a student. It's all free, or is some of it student access only, or how does that work?
So that's up to the instructor to decide. So okay. A course can be designed that is available only to students who are registered in a particular class at Ohio State, or it can be left open to the world.
I was just thinking about the idea that if you go to a lecture and you know that you can listen to it later anyway, and that's happening anyway in a lot of classrooms. What do you get out of being at the lecture in the first place anymore? And I'm wondering how this might be changing how people actually learn.
It definitely is, Ian. And it's funny. That's the number one question that faculty asks us right off the bat. If I put my lectures online, does that mean no one's going to show up in the classroom? And we've actually seen the opposite of that. We see better attendance in our courses that have a flip model.
Well, is that a correlation or a causation? Do you understand what the relationship is yet?
We think we do, and I think we're in the early stages of understanding that more. But by putting that talking head online and the factual information in the lecture and then using that lecture time for discussion to answer questions that the students have, to do interactive experiments with them, they see a lot of value in that hour that they're in lecture instead of just being there spoken to. And they live in a world where at 8 o'clock at night, they don't have to be at home to watch their favorite TV show. They could get it whenever they want. And they're expecting those same things from their education.
I was just thinking about a course I took. He was a German professor, and there were 750 people in the class, and I sat in the front row every day, and I could barely understand what he was saying. And there were other courses from people, from professors from other places that I had a hard time understanding, and thinking how wonderful it would have been if I could have just listened to it more than that one time and understood what he was saying.
Well, we see that. We hear from students that say, you know, I took notes, and either I started daydreaming or I lost track of what you were saying. And I thought, oh, I'd be able to go back at exam time and look at my notes and read the text and I'd be fine. And I realized I wasn't fine. And this gives me the opportunity to go back and hear a lecture, you know, verbatim, or to have some supplemental materials available to me in studying for that exam as well.
So you're saying more kids are showing up, more students are showing up to class. You're not exactly sure why yet. Are they necessarily getting more out of it then because the nature of the class has changed because of the online aspect?
They're definitely more engaged.
Okay.
And we see them more engaged in the type of questions they're asking. When we talk to faculty that have been that we've been working with, the level of question they're asking, their preparedness for class. So, you know, this is not only helping them review the lecture, but driving them to read the text or look at the supplemental materials that we put online, because they are having the experiments and more interested in with the material and in that course.
I think it's important to point out that in the end, all of this is built on good teaching. And so I think it's important to note that we're not trying to advocate for the fact that technology suddenly makes mediocre teaching great. I think that technology can be a fantastic tool to really increase the impact of great teaching in the first place.
But I bet you there's some teachers out there that say, finally, I can express myself differently in an iTunes U course than I can, because maybe when I'm in front of 200 people, I'm a little shyer and I just can't help it. But maybe online or in one of these kind of things, I can do some ancillary materials with the students in a fun way. Do you see that coming out, having a different personality come out of the...
I do. I think that you do see that. And I think something that kind of comes along with that is that students, I think, sometimes are able to engage in ways that they may not, that many students are not going to sitting in a 750-person lecture. So students who can pull out their cell phone and use it to take a vote on a question that a professor is posing in the front of the classroom. And then that professor can, within seconds, have a sense of what their entire group of students' response is or thought is about what the answer to a question is. It's a great way to catch.
They're doing that now?
We're doing that now. So it's their tools that can be used to actually sort of survey the class to understand what their actual understanding of the material is.
Those intense stares are really just glazed over eyes and not understanding.
Right, and to understand then where the problem is. So I could, as a physics professor, ask three different questions and recognize that they've got step one of this concept down, but step two is really where it's starting to break down. So I can look at a graph that says 70% of the students in the class are starting to lose the concept right at this point in my lecture. I mean, it's a tremendous opportunity for feedback for an instructor.
And I think the whole classroom experience is changing as well. We did a short video piece on one of the chemistry classes we've been working with, and someone said to me, they said, you set that up. And I said, well, what do you mean I set that up? But they said, everyone had a computer and everyone had a cell phone. I'm like, yeah, that's the world we live in. And when you have instructors that embrace that and interact with their students in that median, they are finding great successes.
I was listening to a story on NPR the other day about school districts that are now allowing the kids to have their cell phones in the classroom, not only have them in the classroom, but actually have them on and be able to use them when they want and incorporate them into the learning process. Google something really quick if they want to learn what a word means without having to ask the teacher what it means and that sort of thing, because they can just operate that way better than maybe the previous generations would have thought they could.
Well, you know, I think students are coming to class, as Michael said, with these devices. So we can either tell them to turn them off and put them away, or we can find interesting ways to use them. And I know when I think about the job that I do every day, I don't sit there with no computer and no access to information in the outside world. A big part of what I'm trying to do is kind of figure out where I'm going to find the best information and how I can best use it to enhance the work that I do. So if we can teach students to do that in the classroom, I think they end up leaving college that much more prepared for their work in the world.
It's our job to prepare them for that new workforce. And when we look at professions like nursing and being lawyers, and those folks walk around with iPhones and iPads, and they have access to more information than ever before. And we need to help our students embrace that and learn how to work in that world.
If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Right. So if you're engaging them with whatever the materials they have at hand, then they're using them for good instead of evil. I mean, this is a simplified way to put it. I'm wondering about the future of this, and is there a way to make it something that can work for people who aren't able to come in, who can't get to a university, who have to learn long distance? Maybe they live far away and it's just not feasible. Can it change the nature of how we deliver material and education in the future? Right now it's free.
It can. And I think we're experimenting with some of that stuff, those ideas now. We talked a little bit about the flipped classroom where we put lectures online. We have another model that we work with called the High Flex, which is hybrid flexibility, which a student chooses how they want to participate in that class, whether it's in person, online, synchronously or asynchronously. And we've seen tremendous results from the students there around their learning. Grades have improved, and around their participation in class. So as an example, the Friday before Labor Day, which is always a tough time to get students into class, we only had about 3% of our students not show up for class because 60% of them were taking that class synchronously online.
And how does that – what does that mean?
So that means we have a piece of software called Adobe Connect that broadcasts that class out to the internet, and they log on and they could watch that class in person. And because they're responding via a system with their cell phone, they could respond from their bedroom, from their parents' house, from their grandparents' house. And so we're creating this global environment in a classroom at Ohio State.
I think a lot of time when you think of online learning, it feels, or at least probably for my generation, it must be very isolating. You're all alone. And I never missed a class. I was one of those dorks because I like to go and just be there and hear the discussion and hear the questions. It's not isolating anymore. You're there.
Right. So it's a really different experience now in that that students are in the same place. I mean, it's a virtual experience, but they're in the same place with each other. They are asking questions, they're interacting with the professor, and after class they can get on a discussion board and carry these conversations on then even when they're not sitting in the same classroom anymore.
Karen in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Karen.
Hi, this is Erin.
I'm sorry, Erin. Welcome.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Hi, I come from a background of a small liberal arts college in Ohio, and I really enjoyed my time in the classroom with my professors. I was never at a lecture. There was never over 25 students in my class. And I think that that really helped me academically, especially in places like philosophy, where you can really have discussions and interact with students. And then I also took an online class from Ohio State, and that was completely online. And it was great to have all of the lectures online and recorded, so I could listen to them whenever I wanted to, or whenever I needed to, or if I could go back.
Mm-hmm.
But I found that there was less discussion among classmates. And I understand how this online universities really help students, you know, in lecture classes of 700, like you're talking about. But from my background, coming from where I'm in a class with 20, 25 students, and we're all really discussing, I found it a step backward. And maybe it was just that online course, maybe it was just my experience in it, but that's what I have found.
Okay.
And I'm wondering what your guests think about, like, a liberal arts college where you're in a classroom discussing with 20 other people.
Okay. Thank you, Erin.
So thanks, Erin, for the question. You know, I think there's a lot of different models, but I think it's a valid point, and I think it's our job as educators and the folks that work with faculty to design these online courses, and it's why we're doing things like the boot camp to build in those interactions. We can't take what we do in the classroom and just copy it and put it online. It doesn't work. You miss that collaboration. You miss that interaction. And there's things online that we can do to help aid that, but you're never going to have the experience of a 25-person classroom and a 750-person classroom. That's two different learning environments.
That's for sure.
And what we're trying to do at a place like Ohio State, where we have a lot of those big courses, is help bring some of those interactions that you see in the smaller course to the larger.
Thank you, Erin, for that call. We appreciate it. I want to turn to George very quickly in Dublin. Hi, George. You're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for taking the call. I'm a baby boomer, and I grew up in a traditional setting, and I'm a small businessman, and I'm not anti-anything technology. I've kept up with it. However, the traditional classroom holds way more weight to me when I look at someone that I might hire. And I hope it doesn't sound too caustic, but there's something to make about obtaining a degree totally online. So if you can help me by explaining where some of the reality comes in, if someone can complete a degree online, never attend a classroom, how do you even know that that's that person?
Okay. All right. Good question, George. Thanks a lot for your call.
It's
something I've wondered about, too, is how do you know the person that gets the degree online is online? And I know that's not what you guys are purveyors of, but
yeah,
as
but
we look toward the future.
It's an issue. And yeah, I think a lot of these arguments, you can make the same in person. How do you know the person that sits in the classroom is the person that sits in the classroom?
True.
You don't. And I think we actually take a lot more precautions with our online courses in a lot of these cases than we do with our traditional classroom courses. And I either by, you know, verifying who they are, sending them to a proctored exam center, you know, all these things, But I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. but I think it's we are not going to sacrifice the quality of an Ohio State degree because it's online. And I think that's a very important message. We are going to put our online courses, and it's why we're doing things like boot camp again, to ensure that the quality of what we put online meets or exceeds the quality of what
it's
we're putting in the classroom.
It's an incremental process. It's not going to flip over. Quick question from Jennifer on email. Do you need an Apple product to access iTunes U?
You do not.
Okay. And from Amanda on Facebook, she writes, I graduated from college a few years ago. I use iTunes U to learn about subjects that interest me. I find it a great tool to expand my knowledge of the world. So thanks, Amanda, for that comment. And maybe we'll hear from you guys again as things change and evolve.
We'd love to come back.
All right. Well, Liv Yesvung, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Liv, I should say. And also Michael Hoffer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Aaron.
From Ohio's Digital First Initiative coming up. Russell Holly, tech blogger for geek.com. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Time is running out for you to support 89.7 NPR News and register to win an iPad. Our fall membership drive begins soon, and by making your pledge before the start of the drive, you'll be automatically entered to win an iPad. No pledge is necessary, but your support will continue to pay for the programs you enjoy. Entries are only accepted at WOSU.org. So visit WOSU.org right now, make your pledge, and get registered.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Join us for All Sides tomorrow. Same-sex marriage laws in the United States have changed the legal landscape. Wednesday, hear about key legal cases involving same-sex marriage and its issues in modern American society. That's tomorrow on All Sides with Ann Fisher from 10 until noon on 89.7 NPR News. 48 degrees with sunshine warming up to 62 today. Support for 89.7 comes from Mauburn Academy, inviting parents of middle and high school ADHD or dyslexic students to a Mauburn Academy High School Information Session, Thursday, October 11th at 7 p.m. The path to college begins at Mauburn Academy High School. More at mauburnacademy.org. And support for 89.7 comes from Home Care Assistance, in-home care for older adults with a philosophy of promoting health, well-being, and quality of life for all clients, no matter their limitations. Information on Home Care Assistance is at 481-8888. That's 481-8888. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The world of augmented reality has become a trendy marketing tool for companies like Starbucks to incorporate into their products, but it's hardly stopping there, with people spending more time on their smartphones than they do watching television or reading the newspaper. That's for sure. Marketers are using augmented reality apps to hold your attention a little bit longer. As our guest, Tech Tuesday regular, Geek.com blogger Russell Holly recently found out. Welcome to the show, Russell.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
So I am really interested to hear about your pizza box experience. It's kind of like the 21st century version of the prize in the cereal box.
You know, that's
you don't even know what
really
I'm talking about. That's
that. No, I know exactly what you're talking about. How dare you?
So, okay, so tell us about the pizza box, though. This is really interesting.
So I was you know wandering through Walmart with my son, and he's a big fan of the Avengers. He watches the cartoons. He's got a couple of the comic books, and you know we've watched the movie together. And he saw Captain America on a pizza box in Walmart, and I noticed as I was about to tell him no, that you know he wasn't going to have this pizza, that there was a logo on it that said, you know, point your phone at this pizza box with this app. And it'll do a trick. And so immediately the excitement shifted from the 4-year-old being excited about the pizza box to the adult being excited about the pizza box. I could do something with my phone.
Uh-huh.
So, I installed the app pretty quickly. It's called the Superhero AR app. It's free for Android and for the iPhone. And I pointed it at the box, and a city rose up out of the pizza box, and one of the scenes from the movie The Avengers plays out on the top of the pizza box, where the bad guys are fighting the good guys, and it's only 15 seconds or so, but it's this real quick thing, and it was really captivating to see all of that play out on my phone. And then after the video was done, I could take my phone and kind of zoom in on the individual characters and the different points in the city, and it was a complete three-dimensional experience from the phone. And it was really, just captivating. And I bought the pizza box and I took it home so that I could continue to play with this fun new toy that I had found.
So it was in a pizza box. It was like in the freezer department. Is that?
It was a refrigerated pizza. Yeah. It was sitting out in kind of one of those open top refrigerator sections, but it was designed so that you could point your phone at it before you went and did anything. And the technology that drives this is called augmented reality. It's not a easy thing to do. It requires a lot of mapping, because it takes your camera and overlays some artificial information over what your eyes are actually seeing. And it was really impressive to see this happen on something as simple as a pizza box.
And just to be clear, they were actually displaying it because of this augmented reality option.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, the same feature exists. The Superhero AR app works with the pizza box as well as the cover of the Avengers DVD.
Oh, okay. So tell me, what other examples that are out there like that? Is this the same thing as pointing your phone at maybe a for sale sign in front of a house and being able to see something about the house on it? Or
this is a similar kind of experience. Mm-hmm. The augmented reality is really starting to pass into a lot of different things. Basically, if anything that can, if the camera and the program inside the camera can lock onto an image, then it can play the information that's already stored on the phone. And there have been a lot of examples, just very, very small things where people can have something as simple as a T-shirt with an icon on a T-shirt, and you point your phone at the icon on the shirt, and the three-dimensional reality will happen next. There's a storybook that demonstration that was done, probably 3 months ago with Sesame Street characters. You have Bert and Ernie inside of this little house with all these little shapes. But when you pointed your phone at the play area, you could see a bathtub that you could put Bert in with his rubber ducky, or the living room where Ernie liked to sit and stretch out. It was really interesting to see all of this stuff.
It just makes me think of that really super key word that pops up in a lot of our conversations, which is the engagement function.
Oh, absolutely. And we're looking at a situation now where, people have figured out that, ads on your computer can be blocked pretty easily. There are a lot of like antivirus services that are starting to offer that kind of thing. There's a lot going on.
And this makes it fun, too. So you're selling through something fun.
I think what was the most interesting thing about this was that, this was a cool proof of concept, but the opportunity to, embed some kind of actual advertising there was kind of not taken, which I thought was interesting. I mean, they had completely captivated me at that point. If they had had something that said, 10% off of this particular order, it would have, given me, the cause needed to do that. And unlike a traditional advertisement, I had fully set myself up to receive that advertisement.
By the way, just for correction purposes, just to make sure we're all completely onto, Ernie uses the rubber ducky, not Bert.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Yeah. That's okay. You'll.
At least you didn't say that was before my time, too.
It's PBS. Well, it does. It really does, though. Someone wrote that for me, but it does make me think of that prize in the cereal box kind of a thing. Otherwise,
absolutely.
I mean, why else would they ever put those prizes in the cereal boxes or those puzzles on the back, like they did in the olden days, if there wasn't it was engagement. It got you involved in it.
And it's interesting that it that kind of thing confirms, there are certainly, grown-up children like myself, but it confirms the idea that the marketing people are aware that children have access to things with cameras on them that are you know, not unlike smartphones, things like, you know, iPod touches that would offer the same experience.
Right, right, exactly. Let's turn to Open Dyslexic Font. Claims to be dyslexic friendly. How does it work?
So the way that this was explained to me, one of the ways that this works is the font at the bottom is structured so that it's you know, much more solid, much thicker, but at the top it's a lot thinner. So it makes a lot less sense when the words or the letters are flipped or moved, which is a common description of how words are seen from those with dyslexia, because uh-huh. The shape allows all the letters to naturally gravitate to the bottom because they're thicker and heavier on the bottom. And I don't have dyslexia, so I can't say one way or the other, but a lot of the people that I have exposed this to in my life who do have, you know, mild cases of dyslexia have said that their response just in the ability to read, you know, simple sentences is incredibly faster for them.
God, I've heard of so many other ideas like different color screens and all kinds of stuff, but the font and weighting it so that it can't be flipped and confused.
Right. And it really, you know, it sounds pretty simple, but, you know, when you're dealing with computer fonts, making it so that you have that kind of font and making it so that it works on as many different devices as possible is actually really challenging. And when I talked to the gentleman who had been working on this for a long time now, he's gotten it to a point where it's available for Windows, it's available for Mac, it's available on the iPhone. The browser in the iPhone, he's done a lot of work to make it so that, you know, this can be something that replaces, you know, a significant majority of the font that you see when looking at, you know, any kind of digital device. You can put it on your Kindle. There's a lot going on there.
It's free.
It is completely free. It's actually part of a licensing scheme that makes it so that anybody can use it for pretty much anything as long as they give credit to the person who originally created it.
And Open Dyslexic, it's been around for less than a year. It's already been downloaded more than 12,500 times, and I would imagine a lot of that's just word of mouth.
Absolutely. Yeah, he doesn't do any kind of internal marketing. This is something that I found by accident, and I reached out to the gentleman who created it and spoke to him briefly, you know, about his experience with this so far. And really just, you know, this was something that he wanted to do for himself. There were a lot of similar solutions, but they charged as much as $70 per license. So it would be $70 per computer, basically, if these were to be set up in like a school. So it became, you know, prohibitively expensive to implement this on anything more than a single person scale. So he took a lot of the research that he had done and you know, kind of created his own version of this you know, dyslexia friendly font.
And what's his story? How did he decide to do this? Why?
Well, this was just something that, you know, he felt the need for, and he was looking out for, you know, for ways to you know, find a solution for himself.
Oh, he's dyslexic himself.
That was my understanding.
Okay. How did you find it?
I read a lot online, and this was something that it was an application that does a lot of newspaper stuff called Instapaper had implemented Open Dyslexic, and I wasn't really sure what that was, so I did a little bit of research and I found the person responsible for it and reached out to him to learn more.
Well, I would love it if anybody out there has used Open Dyslexic and has had positive, or, you know, if it helped or not. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to our Facebook page and post a question or comment there. Perry in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Perry.
Thank you. I called because I'm so impressed. What a great tool to use in textbooks. You could put those little anagrams or whatever those little squares are on a page. It would show a movie, a slideshow, a PowerPoint. The kids could just be crammed and linked, just like you when you read an article with those blue italics. You could just link onto the information or the author's source. It is a multiplication of power of communication and learning by many, many factors.
Are you talking about augmented reality, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's entirely true. And augmented reality is something that, as long as you have the technical know-how, anyone can do. You know, you just really have to know your stuff. It's non-trivial to set up. It requires a lot of knowledge, but there's no It's all pretty much entirely, you know, open source. So anybody with the right skill set can do it anywhere.
Well, what's keeping the textbook publishers?
Hiring programmers that are skilled enough to do it, I would imagine. It would probably be pretty expensive.
Yeah.
Well, we need that. We just desperately need
I would agree with that.
It could be a whole new lease on life for the textbook companies, in a way.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Perry. Thanks for your call. Well, the Open Dyslexic was really interesting, too, Russell. Thanks for bringing that up. Next, Blue Tiki Microphone. I just like the name, Blue Tiki Microphone.
Blue has got some of the coolest names for some of their microphones. They've had the Snowball and the Yeti and some other really cool names. And so the Tiki and even the packaging for the box has got a little Tiki man that holds the microphone itself. They have a lot of fun with their product names and packaging, and I've always appreciated that about them. But they also are one of the highest quality microphone manufacturers for computers. And it's USB-powered microphone. A lot of times laptops have microphones built in, but anytime you try and type on them, you get very loud, clunky noises for anybody that you're trying to talk to on the other end.
Mm-hmm.
The Tiki is small enough that you can plug it in the USB port on the side because it's separate from the laptop itself. You're not going to get a lot of that feedback, and it's also a higher quality microphone for, you know, things like conversations or really anything that you would want to do. And it works on just about every computer. I mean, it works on every computer I've plugged it into. It's a very smart little piece of technology that I've really appreciated recently.
One person who wrote about it said that purchasing a USB microphone for the sole purpose of video chatting will be a tough sell for most folks. People like podcasters will expect a bit more functionality from a peripheral like this. Luckily, the unit boasts a natural recording mode. What's that?
So the idea behind the natural recording mode is that it adjusts based on your environment. It has a, like I said, there's a lot of technology in this little piece of equipment, and in the event that there's, you know, a lot of noise, maybe if you're conducting an interview or something like that, then it will actually automatically adjust using the built-in software that it has to filter out a lot of that information, and it will intelligently mute, you know, it'll turn itself off in environments where it's clear that, you know, there's not one specific conversation going on.
And $60 worth it to you?
I would definitely say so. The problem with the statement that that people who are going to be using, you know, microphones for communication aren't going to be interested in spending this much for a microphone is that, you know, this is becoming increasingly popular with people who are using things like FaceTime or mm-hmm. people who are having conversations over Skype. And the interesting thing about Skype and FaceTime is that they both work with computers and mobile devices. The most complicated thing about having a conversation with someone on a mobile device is making sure that the person with the phone is able to hear you as you know, well as possible. So it's important that the person sitting at a computer has control over you know, their audio connection to make sure that they can provide the best sound. And this is, you know, one of the best ways to do that.
Is this the same company that made those jelly jar speakers?
No, this is not the same company. they're different companies. These guys just do microphones, and they do such a wide range of microphones. They do really, really good stuff.
Well, Russell, thanks for joining us this week again. As always, you know, Christmas is coming up. I hope you're making your list.
I am definitely making a list. There's so many exciting things coming out in the next couple of weeks. It's hard to pick and choose, but we're going to have a good list soon.
Okay, cool. Thanks, Russell. It's Russell Holley. He's tech blogger for Geek.com. Thanks for joining us today. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.